Hey there, everybody. It's March 31st, 2019, and it's your episode 177 of At Percussion. My name is Casey Cangelosi, and with me are a few of my co-hosts. We've got Carly Vigna.
Hi, everyone.
And Ben Charles is here.
Hi, everybody.
Well, you guys, our guest is a good friend of mine and a newly appointed principal timpanist with the Seattle Symphony. Prior to that, he was the associate principal percussionist and assistant principal timpanist of the Fort Worth Symphony. He's performed with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, the Boston Pops, Malaysian Philharmonic, the Sarasota Orchestra, the New World Symphony, and the West Virginia Symphony. He's been on the faculty with the University of Pittsburgh and the Lucerne Music Center. He was my roommate back in the Boston days when Halo 2 was something people still did. And do you remember that, Jimmy?
I do, yeah.
This is Jim Benoit. Welcome to the show. It's so good to see you again.
You too. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk and have some fun.
Yeah, sure. You're welcome. How long have you been with the Seattle Symphony? It says newly appointed principal timpanist.
Yeah, so I started in an official capacity with a contract in September at the beginning of this season. So I've been a little less than a year, a full-time member. But I actually started playing with the orchestra about a year ago. I had won the audition and I moved to Seattle. Yeah, it's still pretty new, but a lot happens in a year, so I feel like, you know, I've been in Seattle for quite some time.
When you say official capacity, is the first year like a trial year after winning the audition?
Yeah, every orchestra does it differently, but for our orchestra, there's a one-year probationary period. Mm-hmm. So essentially your first year, you're trying to get tenured. And it can be extended, it can be obviously confirmed or denied. But so for me, even though I had started performing with the group earlier, none of the 10-year stuff really was applicable until September, at the beginning of the new season. So this is kind of, September marks like my official start. Yeah.
Cool. Well, congrats, man. That's really, really cool.
Thank you. No, it's been really exciting. And, I'm sure, you know, anyone, whether it's an orchestra job or a teaching job or anything that you really spend a lot of time aspiring towards, like once you kind of hit that big mark, it's not the end of the journey, but it's like a big benchmark that I think is really exciting. And it's fun to kind of, you know, have hit that benchmark and now to be trying to, you know, get tenured and just to get better as a musician and a colleague. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Can you explain for our, especially our young listeners real quick, you mentioned that the way your orchestra does it, the way the Seattle Symphony does it, is there's a one-year probationary period. Can you give us just at least what you know of how else that might work at other orchestras?
Sure. So here, the way it works is it's 1 year. So you get, you know, you win your job. And then after you start in our orchestra, there's a 1 year period where essentially there's a committee that is in charge of, you know, granting you tenure. And so for me, the way it works is I've already had one meeting. There's going to be a total of 3 meetings where they're kind of like checkups. So my colleagues will be talking, you know, throughout the year about things that they like that I'm doing, things that I don't like, and talking to the music director and talking to, you know, for me, there's a head of my committee that's kind of having a big role in gathering all this information. So at my first meeting, I basically went into the music director's office and had a meeting with the personnel manager, with the music director, and with someone on the players committee. And they gave me all this feedback. And yeah, so essentially every orchestra does this differently though. So other orchestras, it's a 2-year process. I'm sure there might be some other orchestras where it's, and you know, even more extended process. And essentially what it is you're getting feedback about how you're doing. And, you know, and based on that feedback, you kind of are expected to, you know, grow and change. And I think it's everyone's hope, because the audition process is so challenging, that, you know, you grow into the person that they want you to be and hired you to be, and you get tenured. And yeah, I mean, some orchestras, there are some different situations, like there might be an orchestra that you might join and you already have tenure and, you know, you're like a really high profile player, so that you can apply for some orchestras to like early tenure and things like that. But I don't really have specific knowledge of that stuff. So I just know for ours, it's a 1-year process. And yeah.
you know, of course, I'm in my fourth year here at JMU. And yeah, I have to think about tenure in 1 year. So third year review paperwork was like a mountain like that.
Yeah.
Tenure review will be a additional mountain on top of that mountain. And
for sure.
Yeah. Wow. 1 year. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I mean, it can always be extended. You know, there are a lot of things right. that can happen, but it's, you know, I think it's with our orchestra, it's a really great environment of everyone is rooting for everybody. And I think the goal with the 1 year thing is to basically have everyone feel good about, you know, you get hired and everyone's rooting for you. So I think it's part of it is also like a vote of confidence to say, hey, you know, we hired you. We really like what you're doing, and we want you to be a part of our group, our family. And so, you know, for me, I really, it's nerve wracking being in the year, you know, but you're hopefully, you know, it goes well and then you feel more stability versus if it's like a longer period, I think, you know, so you might get nervous that, you know, what am I doing? I'm going to spend 2 years here and then it might not work out. And, you know, it can, I guess, raise some anxiety. So, yeah, I'm glad. Right. Your process though. So
on the Beethoven 9 scherzo, if you went up on the two Fs instead of down, would they know that it was a joke or would that be a mark?
Oh man, you know, I guess it depends on who you're talking to.
Try it and see, man. Try it and see.
Are you gonna try it and see? Yeah, right. I'm sorry, Ben. I think you had something for Jim there.
Yeah, well, speaking of the Seattle Symphony, we always hear about orchestras today are all going bankrupt and folding all this stuff. And Seattle Symphony actually seems to be one of the ones that's doing quite well. And I know there's a lot of innovative programming. And if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, if you go on YouTube and you start to type Seattle Symphony, the first thing that comes up is Seattle Symphony, Baby Got Back. Because 4 years ago, they had Gabriel Prokofiev, Sergei Prokofiev's grandson, arranged Baby Got Back for the Seattle Symphony, and they performed it with Sir Mix-a-Lot, and it's really awesome. They have girls come up on stage and dance. You should definitely check it out. But anyway, I was going to ask Jim, could you tell us about, is that Sonic Evolution project that was part of, is that still going on? And what are some of the other innovative ways that Seattle Symphony is programming and reaching new audiences while retaining its legitimacy as a classical orchestra?
Sure. I mean, it's a loaded question. And I think for me, I can only speak on, you know, what I've experienced since being here. But I think there's a couple different prongs that are at play, if you will. One is there are these long-term visions of, for example, we have a new performance space that we just opened called Octave 9. And it's a space that fits about 100 people. And it's designed to kind of be very innovative in terms of more chamber music and bringing in different types of artists. So there are things like that where it's not performing with the symphony in terms of like a symphony concert, but that the orchestra is really proud of and really excited about their role in kind of continuing this type of innovation, bringing in lots of new composers. And when we had like a 24-hour chamber music marathon there a week ago. And when we did that, a lot of it was local composers. So there's a lot of elements like trying to really create innovation and also relate it to Seattle and the community. But another big part of it is honestly just really, you know, really innovative programming with the orchestra, like you're talking about with Sir Mix-a-Lot. And just because it was recent, one thing we did and the orchestra's been doing for quite some time now are these concerts which are called Untitled Concerts. So a couple times a year, there'll be a concert that's more contemporary music or chamber music oriented. And what they'll do is they'll set it up in the middle of our grand lobby. So this isn't on stage. This will be kind of in the middle of the lobby. And then there'll be chairs set up around the lobby. And the way our lobby is structured, there's also balconies above. So people can sit around at any point to see, you know, you can sit behind the musicians, you can sit to the side of the musicians, you can stand and walk around, you can go above and look down on the musicians. And while this is going on, usually there'll be kind of like a bar set up, and these concerts are Friday nights at 10 p.m. So it's kind of like a different vibe, if you will. So it's not really feeling like the concert hall. And like recently, for example, we did a heavy percussion program where two of our percussionists, Mike Warner and Matt Decker, did Barrio Circles, which is a great piece. And then afterwards, we actually tried to tackle Boulez Sur and Seas, which is awesome piece, involves three percussion, three harp, three piano. It's a really amazing work by Boulez. And so anyways, these are programs that I think for a lot of normal concert goers, these wouldn't be what you would expect to see, right? And I think one thing Seattle's really conscious of and does a great job of is really trying to expand our audience's appreciation for whether it's different composers or different types of concerts. So ideally, you know, you're bringing in people who come to the concert hall, but then you're bringing in people who might not want to go and see a two-hour symphony concert, and they come and they see this really cool concert involving different sounds, different instruments, and then from there, you know, hopefully bring them in to become full-time subscribers, if you will, or just people who want to check out the normal or more normal, you know, symphony concerts. So I think, you know, the big thing is everyone in Seattle in terms of part of the organization is really trying to kind of build innovation everywhere they can and all and have it kind of have continuity and relate back and forth. And I think that's a big part of why, as you were saying, Seattle right now at least is doing really well in the orchestra world. So, yeah. It's and it's also fun and inspiring for us to be part of such diverse concerts.
So. Wow, cool.
You know, I was reading something recently about how a lot of musicians report like higher job satisfaction when they're involved in other aspects like planning, repertoire, administration in some ways. So, Jim, with so many innovative things going on programming-wise, are the musicians involved in planning like some of this adventurous repertoire and different venues and things like that?
Yeah, I think so. There are different committees in the orchestra. Like there's artistic committees where they really do. The musicians have a strong voice that I know our management and administration and music director listen to. For me personally, I'm not. I don't know a lot of the details of those things yet, just because I'm still a probationary musician. But yeah, I mean, I think you find talking to the musicians in the orchestra that everyone is really excited about the path that Seattle's on right now. I think there's a really good dynamic within the concert hall where musicians feel like their voices are being heard. And also I think they feel that if they have an idea for some type of new progressive concert, you know, they can talk to someone about it and it might happen. And I think that's a really powerful feeling, not just in an orchestra like this, but any organization, if any employee has that sense of confidence and trust that they can propose an idea and that the people who are technically maybe above them in the hierarchy of the company might listen and make it happen. I mean, that's really powerful. And I think that leads to innovation.
You're talking about like employee satisfaction. I'll say that a few years ago, Carly and I performed in Miami this piece by some big like EDM guy named BT. It was like the BT, what was it called? Electronic Symphony or something like that. And I will say, I mean, like, you know, obviously Carly and I would probably rather be performing Brahms, but it was probably the only time in my life I've ever gotten to perform in a symphony and have people just losing it, just like screaming the whole time. And so it is like, it's like, all right, well, like that was different and fun also in its own special way. And I think that, you know, I do like I got to play some Beethoven a few months ago in a very good orchestra. But yeah, I mean, it's fun to have the variety of different reactions. Have you had any like Sir Mix-a-Lot type artists where you've gotten to perform with just like a bizarre different crowd than you normally would?
The best example that comes to mind is actually a year ago when I was playing in Fort Worth and we had Boyz II Men come and play with the orchestra.
Wow.
And initially they had programmed it as a one night thing. So we would have a rehearsal and then one show and that was it. And it immediately sold out and they had to add another show. And, you know, a lot of times with various pop shows, people wear earplugs because, you know, it'll be loud with a live band or something. This was the only show where I had to have earplugs in because of how loud the audience was. And I mean, Boyz II Men, I think was popular when I was in high school or middle school, maybe. So it was a really awesome experience going in and kind of having a vague idea of what this band did and knowing some of their songs. And then just as soon as they did anything, just the pandemonium in the audience, it was really exciting. And I know what you mean. I mean, a lot of times those concerts are the most fun because you just feel this energy from the audience that's really incredible. And yeah, I mean, it was definitely one that I remember.
I will say also, like when you're playing Beethoven, you feel like you're under like the, you know, the microscope, like, oh, if I screw anything up even a little bit, like I'm in big, you know, big trouble. And it's not to say that you're going to, you know, have a great screw up in the Boyz II Men concert, but it's definitely a little bit liberating to be able to like just go for it and not worry if, oh, you know, oh, that was a tiny bit sloppy or something like that. Because, yeah, it's popular music. It's like it's more about the vibe of it, I guess, than the, you know, absolute accuracy.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, I remember specifically feeling pretty excited about some suspended civil roles in that show. And meaning, because, you know, I remember I talked to the drummer, because a lot of times these people don't realize with these pop shows, a lot of times these books are written by maybe the keyboardist or the drummer in the band, or the arrangement, excuse me, not the tunes are written, but the arrangement will be written by. And I remember talking to the drummer, and he kind of just said, yeah, if you want to add something, go right ahead. And, you know, I think a lot of times is classical musicians who are playing, as you're saying, like Beethoven, or playing what someone would maybe classify as more serious music. I think you don't feel that liberation. And I'm not saying people should go and improvise in Beethoven, but what I more mean is I think there are settings where you can really feel like, okay, I can take some liberty, and whether that liberty means adding notes or whether that liberty means maybe just feeling like you can give a little extra something in a crescendo, you know, I think that's where it depends on what type of music and you're playing and what the composer is. But for the Sir Mix-a-Lot, I'm sure people were really going for it and having fun. And I know for me in the show in Fort Worth, there was a lot of, okay, like the drummer's looking at me, I'm going to add a little role here. And then, you know, sharing a smile and stuff like that really makes performances really, really stand out.
Yeah, I just, also speaking of that show, the BT show I was talking about with Carly, I think that was one of the points where I've never seen Carly so mad at me, because it was my job to bring a gong and it was Carly's job to play the gong. And I brought the stand, but I forgot the gong. And Carly was like, you're going to make me look like an idiot. We managed to borrow a gong from University of Miami. So thanks, Jet, for that. And all was well. Carly did get to play her gong, so everything was good.
I thought that story was on the Bartok Sonata. It was this piece, or has it happened twice?
Oh, no, it was just on this piece.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, the Bartok I struggled equally through.
Well, I was going to ask Jim, on one of those arrangements as the timpanist, I imagine sometimes the arranger, you know, do they just give you the bass line? Do you have to pedal galore?
So the show I was talking about in Fort Worth, I was playing percussion. But
okay.
When I've seen some of these on timpani, I haven't seen any where they just give you, you know, the bass part and say, do whatever you want.
Right.
I think sometimes what I find with these arrangements, it's funny because sometimes it's like very dense writing. Sometimes it's something that seems, if you're used to just playing Mozart or playing Beethoven, it seems strange because it is kind of like a bass line. And then other times, you know, you're kind of sitting there not playing at all and you're thinking, why are there not low timpani notes with this bass line? You know, so a lot of it I think is so dependent on whoever's arranging it and, you know, kind of what they had in mind. And some of it, a lot of this stuff is just written on the fly, like a MIDI keyboard, which I think you realize sometimes as you're playing it, but that can also just affect how thickly or densely something is written. So for example, you know, maybe with the bass line, the composer wanted it to come out a lot and he's sitting at the MIDI keyboard going, what instrument can I also add to this, right? And then he'll add timpani. And so it's not something that would normally be a timpani part, but it's musically, it's like, okay, I needed something to really bring this out. And the reverse can be true where it's, you know, hey, we want it to be like really thinly orchestrated. And so let's not have any timpani or percussion. And then, you know, you might sit there looking at your part going, I could play all this really cool stuff, but it's not really what the guy had in mind. So,
right, right.
Yeah.
Well, can you take us back a little bit? And yeah, so you and I are in Boston. And I remember you were on your way to one of your early, I don't know if it was the first lesson, probably not, because you would have had to have gotten this assignment from Mr. Rabio, but you're studying with Saul Rabio, the Saul Rabio. And I remember you telling me something. You know, Jimmy, what are you doing in your lesson coming up? And you said, well, I had to learn all the Beethoven symphonies. Was that in 1 week, 1 month? I remember it was a very short time to learn all the symphonies. Am I remembering that right?
Definitely not in 1 week.
I was going to say, I think I've been telling everyone it was 1 week.
Cool. I like that because that makes
me feel pretty impressive. Okay, I'll continue saying that.
No, I mean, so, you know, I don't have a specific recollection of this moment, unfortunately, because I could tell you exactly what was going on. But, you know, studying with him was incredible. And one of the things that we did a lot was preparing works like Beethoven symphonies or overtures or other works by other composers. And he would want you to be able to play with any recording. So he could just turn a recording on. And obviously there are going to be moments where if something comes out of a fermata and there kind of needs to be a conductor. So there are moments like that where it's you're kind of guessing. But his point was that you had to just know the score well enough that not only could you play with a recording that you would practice with, but he could play different recording. And in those different recordings, obviously tempos could be different. The orchestra could tune differently. They could tune to 440 versus 442 or something like that. And there could be all sorts of different variables. And his whole, I think, thought process was you should know this well enough that you hear these differences and can adjust on the fly. So I do have a very strong memory of just in general, the night before these lessons with Mr. Rabbio, just listening to all sorts of recordings with the score. And, you know, having done that before also, I wasn't, usually at least, wasn't trying to cram, but just trying to be ready for anything that could happen. And so it was, I mean, studying him in general was an amazing experience, but also just, I found like things like this, which maybe aren't what you would work on if you're just trying to prepare for an audition. For me, it gave me a lot of confidence as a freelancer when I was freelancing to go in and just kind of be ready to play in different settings. But then also, you know, when I was able to either play timpani as a freelancer or just get it, you know, getting this timpani gig, things like that gave me confidence just to know that, you know, I've been doing a lot of work that's kind of been preparing me for playing with an orchestra. And it really helped.
So there's a couple on here that seem to be somewhat related. So I'll ask both of them and maybe you can sort of wrap them up. So Randy Wong asks, Jim has a lot of improvisational and non-classical experience as a jazz vibist when he was at Berklee. How did this play into his artistic development and does he recommend it for aspiring orchestral musicians? And then also Steve Fitch asks, have you ever improvised over the changes on timpani on a jazz chart?
Jim, I still remember your arrangement of Senor Mouse on Vibe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was so good.
Thanks, man. Yeah, no, I remember working on that a lot. The first easy answer is I have not improvised over jazz changes on timpani. that would be, in a way, the most obvious connection of the different things I've worked on in terms of jazz vibes and timpani, right? Put them together.
We appreciate not doing that.
Try to become a jazz timpani soloist. So I have not done that. But yeah, I mean, I had a very, I guess, interesting, unique path where I went to school in Boston and I was studying classically when I was in Boston. I want to make sure people know that and don't assume I kind of just was some, you know, jazz prodigy that decided to play classical music and can. I had great high school teachers who really both pursued me to work on classical things, work on jazz, work on hand drums, to really just have a broad background. And I think when I got to Boston for school, there were so many schools there and so many different amazing musicians. So I started off at Boston Conservatory. And at the conservatory, there were just incredible both students and then teachers. I mean, you had Nancy Zeltzman, who's a world-class marimbist. You had John Grimes, who was this really amazing Baroque timpanist. You had Sal Rabbio, who was in the area, who was this renowned timpanist. You had the Boston Pops guys. Then you had the Boston Symphony guys. Then at Berklee, you had people who were world-class drum set players, jazz vibe players, etc. So, I mean, it was really overwhelming to go in as somebody who was interested in everything and to have everything really at your fingertips. I mean, there's like a handful of places in the world where you could really get that kind of training. You know, it was incredible. So for me, I really had always been interested in jazz vibes, and I decided to kind of spend some time really focusing on that. So I was at Berklee. I transferred to Berklee and was studying as a jazz vibes major. And then while that was happening, I was also taking classical lessons, primarily with Sal Rabbio, who at the time lived in Cape Cod, which is pretty close. It's like a 2-hour bus ride. So I mean, it's not a straightforward answer of like, would I recommend this to someone and how did it specifically help me? I think it made my path maybe a little bit longer and windier than it is for other people. More meaning like if you decided you wanted to be a timpanist or a orchestral percussionist with in an orchestra, you know, I think your path would and probably should be not quite as windy as mine was. But I do think that having these other things that you pursue, other interests, is important because I think it helps you develop just as a musician, like a unique voice. And not to say that, you know, when you go and play to win a job behind a screen, you have to sound like someone who studied jazz vibes or something like that. But I do think that it, for me personally, it really helped develop all these things that really form who I am as a musician today. And like on the practical side, like studying jazz vibes made learning notes really easy. So for example, then if I'm trying to learn a piece of music, whether it's Boulez a couple weeks ago, or whether it's just trying to work on a xylophone part or something, you know, from all the jazz vibe training helped me to really see patterns quickly. So that was really helpful because then you start to see patterns instead of looking at all these notes and kind of trying to figure out how I'm going to learn them right away. I would kind of say, oh, like that's a pentatonic scale, or like, oh, that's this kind of dominant chord. And I know it you know, doesn't mean that I can play it right away, but little things like that would help, you know, kind of connect the dots. Another thing too, is I do think that, you know, when you work on something like jazz vibes or hand drums, you're essentially working on something that is, it's like really making you have to learn styles. And I think that's one thing that we don't think about when we kind of put things in big boxes like classical music and jazz and Latin or whatever you want to label things as. But like within classical music, there are so many styles, right? Beethoven is a different style, different composer than Mozart, than Bartok, than Brahms. And I think as someone who's playing these excerpts at an audition, or just someone who's trying to play them with a group, you know, you really need to notice these differences in style and make it really clear. And I think for me, like studying a completely different genre, if you want to put jazz in a different category than classical, it really helped me to identify different styles. So then when I came back and was working on like excerpts for a timpani audition, you know, you start to see little and hear little differences. And then you have these realizations of, okay, like I can make a bigger difference between these two composers. And how can I, you know, and like little things like that, I think, which then really do make a big difference in the presentation, if it's an audition you're giving, or just in the effect of playing in the group you have. And the last thing I'll say is that I think just performing different types of music helps you as a performer, you know, and I think with everything, not just music, the more you kind of get outside of your comfort zone, the more that you kind of build confidence and it allows you to kind of expand your comfort zone, if you will. So, you know, it doesn't have to be jazz vibes, but if you're someone who's a classical musician and then you're playing a lot of drum set, like that's going to help your time a lot. That's going to help, you know, your sense of styles we're talking about and your sense of rhythm. And then when you go back to playing any type of percussion part in an orchestra, it's going to help you right away to then feel more at home and at ease. So I think like all these things, it's a complicated, you know, it's complicated. It's not as easy as to say you should pursue jazz vibes and this, or you should pursue these different things. But I do think that expanding your horizon a little bit does have a lot of benefit, regardless of what career path you're trying to go down.
This reminds me so much of the way back when Jason Haheim episode where he talked about, I mean, Jason had like,
oh, yeah,
the weirdest career path of like, you know, basically majoring in science and then kind of going, you know, I think I want to play timpani and coming back around to that. And I was just also going to add that if anyone does want to hear some jazz timpani, we talked about on William Mersch's episode, Jonathan Haas has certainly done a bit of that. There's some little YouTube clips online. But one thing on the Jason Haheim episode that I talked about that I was so excited to talk about was the Elliot Carter 8 Pieces for Timpani. And I did this great presentation on it. And then Jason was like, yeah, I actually haven't played those.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So I was hoping we could dovetail that into, Jim, have you played those? And have you had experiences with those pieces?
Sure.
I played 3 of them. I played March, Canaries, and Saeta. I don't have very vivid memories of like preparing them in terms of just, I couldn't tell you stickings or anything like that offhand, I don't think, maybe. But But yeah, I do think kind of in a smaller way, this is kind of like what I was just saying with the pursuing other styles and things, where I think if you're trying to teach someone to become like a timpanist in an orchestra, I think I wouldn't treat these like the Bach cello sonatas, where it's kind of like you're always working on them and they're working on your intonation and your sound and your expression and how you're connecting notes. But I think that they're amazing in that, A, they're just really hard and they force you to work on different skills that are important, whether it's like rhythmic modulation or getting different sounds. And I think that B, it's also just, as someone is trying to learn the instrument, it's the same thing if you work on a marimba piece that uses maybe like different effects that aren't quite as standard, where that I think it just forces you to open up a little bit and it expands your ears. So for me, for example, with the Carter things, I mean, you know, at the time, as someone who, you know, played mainly straightforward, I would say like symphonic type timpani playing, where you're not doing as extreme things with beating spots, for example. I think like you just think I have a good beating spot. You know, this is where the beating spot is. It's where I get the most pitch or whatnot. And I think when you work on a piece, you know, there are other pieces too, but like some of the Carter pieces where you're doing these things where you're in the middle and then you're in the edge and then you're close to the rim, it forces you to hear the differences and the different things they can bring out. And not to say that then you'd go to a Beethoven symphony and say, I'm going to play this in the middle and it's going to be great. But I think it forces you to really start to hear differences. And then you realize that, okay, there are benefits to playing closer to the middle, depending on what the type of, you know, writing is for timpani, or there are benefits to playing closer to the edge at times. And I think for me, at least, that's what that kind of piece has had an effect on, is it's made me kind of see that there is a lot of possibilities with the instrument. There's not just one good beating spot. There's a variety of sounds and colors you can get, and doing things like going towards the middle or towards the edge really can make certain things more or less successful. But also the other thing is they're just cool pieces. I mean, so if you want to be a timpanist, it's like you should play some of the cool timpani pieces. And without a doubt, the Carter pieces are part of that.
So to follow up with that, Jim, are there other pieces or other repertoire or other method books that you think are really important for young timpanists to play when they're studying?
Yeah, I think the Goodman book, there's some books that I think are pretty, I don't want to say pretty standard as in you have to use them. I just think they're books that have kind of been around for a while. So for me, the two books that I used a lot with Mr. Rabio, for example, when I was studying with him, were the Goodman book, and then there's the Freezy Lipak book, which has a lot of tuning in it. And I think what's maybe unique about these books is that they really focus on the basics quite a bit. And I think that with everything, but especially with timpani, because most of what you end up playing compared to other percussion writing, for example, is so maybe, let's say, basic. Like there's not buzz rolls, for example, and there's only so much you can do with these four drums. So much of it is about just getting a good sound and playing in tune and playing with, you know, good rhythm. So I think these books are great because if you really focus on them, that's what it is. You know, the basic etudes for the Goodman book are playing roles, playing different dynamics, and playing different intonation exercises. And then same with the Freezy Lipak book. And with the Freezy Lipak book specifically, what's so great is there's this section in there, I'm sure people who worked on the book know this, there's this section where you're playing and singing. So they give you they'll give you pitches and you have to sing. So you have to work on hearing the pitches and producing it, and then you work on playing and tuning it. And I think that's one thing that, you know, is the quality of timpani are so good now, it's really easy to go up and just use the gauges and to set up a perfect fourth, or, you know, name the interval, right? You can kind of use the gauges, and in general the drums are so good that it's going to get you pretty close. But in order to be perfectly in tune, what you need with the orchestra, you know, you really have to be able to sing these intervals and hear them. And for a lot of people, that goes down to having like a great ear training instructor, but these books do a great job of kind of really reinforcing that. So for me, those are kind of the ones that I keep even now going back to. Like if I haven't played in a month or something, if I took a trip and I wanted to come back and get back into shape, a lot of it would be going back to these basic etudes and exercises, really making sure I can do them at a high level instead of kind of just pulling, you know, something really complicated and trying to right away just dive in. I kind of would start with the basics.
One other book I wanted to add that I'm actually kind of surprised Jim didn't mention is the Sal Rabbio book. which is, it's called, is it 14, I can't remember, let's see here, I just Googled it, Contest and Recital Solos for Timpani.
Yeah.
But they're also, like, not the most, like, I think the Vic Firth etudes kind of get into a little too, like, almost multi-tom sort of, like, difficulty level stuff. They're not super difficult, but there's really, really a ton of music, and that's what I use with my students. And I think, book, like, one of the biggest sins with that book is that they're called, like, Solo 1, Solo 2, and I'm always like, make up a name for it and, you know, play that. So it adds so much more color.
I'll tell him next time I talk to him. But no, yes, that book's great. So wrong. Yeah. No, I'll tell him. You have notes.
Ben Charles said, Mr. Rabbio, you need to title these.
Yeah, no, and I think, for me, that book's great. That book, actually, he wrote it after I had kind of spent most of my time studying with him. So part of the reason I have such a, part of the reason the book we're talking about, the Leepak book and the Goodman, have had such an impression on me is because I spent just years with Mr. Rabbio playing these basic etudes from him, and him just kind of looking at me and, you know, is that a true fourth? And then me kind of face going red and then going down and trying to tune again and coming back up. And, you know, so I think it comes from that place. And I think when he wrote his book, you know, I don't want to speak for him, but it seems to me that he really had this idea of, you know, I want to write something that people can play in a musical way and people can approach it at every level. So it's not something where you need to have these crazy chops to do. It's not something that, you know, you have to be a master. He wanted to write something that, you know, is someone who's an adventurous student you could do and try to do musically, or if you're someone who's a professional timpanist, you could do and try to really play it musically.
Yeah, I think number three in that book is, like, one of my, like, just favorites of all time. It's one with C, E flat, F as the tuning. And I actually, there was one studio class here where I performed it for my students. Like, I actually went in for a week and practiced this, like, freshman level timpani etude, then went and performed it for my students, because it's like, yeah, there's so much there that I think oftentimes we just don't really scratch the surface of.
Yeah. No, and one thing I want to say about him, just because for me, he had such a profound influence on me in terms of the we're talking earlier about jazz and things. I mean, he had me transcribe melodies for timpani, you know, and I think we in the classical world maybe think of transcriptions as something that jazz players do to work on improvising. Don't really think a lot about it, but he had me, I don't remember offhand one. I remember Danny Boy was one he assigned me one time. And, you know, he would just pick melodies and just say, you know, I want you to transcribe this and put it in a key that works for the timpani and figure it out. And, you know, sometimes it was to do something that was challenging and that was really, he wasn't sure how you were going to do it. There wasn't like a right or wrong way. It was kind of just like, good luck, you know, let's see what you come up with. But yeah, and I mean, so it's that kind of outside the box thinking that I think was amazing from him. And one thing, I'll just bring this up because it's related. I took a while ago the Chicago Symphony Principal Timpani audition that Dave Herbert won. And they asked for a melodic timpani solo, I think. Maybe it just said timpani solo. Might have said melodic. I don't remember. But so for that, I remember for me, I actually transcribed a opera aria and tried to play it on timpani. And so that's the kind of thing where, you know, it's not that that's what you have to do, but I think a lot of people think of timpani in a certain way. And I think if you're someone who's trying to become, you know, whether you're trying to become a professional timpanist or just a better timpanist than you are today, like things like this, which seem a little outside the box, can be really rewarding. You know, I mean, if you're trying to transcribe something on timpani, you're learning about the ranges of the timpani, like how low and how high can each drum go. You're learning about intonation and what is possible pedaling, you know. And then you're also learning about effects, like, oh, you know, I know teachers really stress with pedaling timpani, making it exact so you're not hearing a gliss, right? But then sometimes, like in a string solo, you'll hear a little bit of a gliss between notes. And so it's an effect that they'll connect notes. So then as a timpanist, like, are there times you want to do that? I don't know. But these are things that I think working on some of these kind of cool outside of the box projects, you know, they can really have big positive impact on you, you know, not just in that project, but then way down the road.
Do you know what Dave Herbert's melodic solo was?
Oh, man, I forgot. I think it was
Stars and Stripes Forever?
Yes. Yeah. Stars and Stripes. Right.
Oh, really? Wow. How do you know that, Ben?
I think we talked about it at some point, maybe on Jason's episode.
Oh, really? I need to invite him on. I've been talking to Cynthia Yeh just over email, and of course, Chicago Symphony's having a strike right now. So I'm trying to. It's not really much news or to talk about. I mean, of course, it's a big deal for them, but it is the typical thing that we've talked about on the show before. I think back on Tony Cerone's episode, we were talking about the. Pittsburgh Symphony strike, which actually I think, Jim, you were in Pittsburgh at that time, if I remember.
Yeah, I was freelancing with the orchestra a little bit and teaching around the area. So yeah,
we'll have to have Dave Herbert on too. That would be really fun. I was going to say, I bet he played like Cat Scratch Fever or something.
Yeah, if you go on, who's the guy? He's like the timpanist in. Somewhere in New Zealand or Australia, Stephen Logan.
Okay.
Steve Schick.
Yeah, no, that's not it.
No, I think Steve Logan.
There's a video of Stephen Logan playing that Stars and Stripes Forever arrangement with it's a percussion section at some festival. But I was going to say, it sounded like we're talking a lot about, you know, pedaled timpani music. And I think any high school senior, college freshman wants to like set the pedals. I have my perfect fourth, and then I just get to sort of ignore it and hit the drums. And one other book is: have you guys ever heard of the Ron Horner book called The Tuneful Timpanist?
It's
exactly like what Jim was talking about, although probably with a bit more guidance. But basically, play Frère Jacques on timpani or something like that, and. Here's which drums you put it on, leave this pitch as sort of an anchor note, and then you can pedal from there. And I never actually played out of that book myself, although I've had a couple students do it. But I did those sorts of exercises before playing the Bartok to get used to being able to play a part of a scale on timpani or something like that.
Right. Yeah. No, and there are some other books I probably should have mentioned. I mean, the Hochreiner books are all great. They're pretty, it's kind of standard timpani etudes compared to some of the stuff we're talking about, but they're all fantastic. Trying to think of what I used a lot. I mean, I think there's a George Martingly book that has, it's like pedaling melodies. So there's a lot of it starts out with maybe doing something that's fourths and fifths where you're essentially doing whole steps in each pedal quite a bit, but part of the thing now is there's so many books now, it's almost, for me, it's almost overwhelming just because I kind of really worked with a few books and really worked on them many times almost. I mean, I remember I went from studying with Sal Rabbio to studying with Marcus Roten in New York, and Marcus had us do the Lee Peck book also. So it was like, I'd already done the book and then I started over and did the book again. And so I think, there are plenty of books. So if I haven't mentioned it, I am not saying it's not a good book. there's just so many out there now that, and part of it is it's great. It means there's so many great teachers out there. So it's an exciting time to be a drummer.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm gonna give Jim a quick break. I have a short little sound for you all today. Pretty sure that tune would be good to transcribe on timpani. anybody have an idea what that is? Ben, you might. Yeah. So you've reported several times on the show about the Deegan Company, right? And this is something called the Deegan Tower Chimes. I'm going to send you all a little link here in the chat so you can take a peek at this. So the Deegan Company made something called their tower chimes, and they would go install this giant chime rig into the belfries of churches. And I don't know if they exist any universities. The brochure is still available. You can download the original brochure, which I just sent a link to you guys. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can take a peek. I'll overlay all this and you can take a look. But yeah, it's this 1930 is the catalog, and it's saying that this electric electrically operated, automated chime belfry that can be installed. And it looks like for the biggest set of them, the price is $13,000. And if you get the console and the timer and the little piano roll mechanism, it's $15,000, which today is $180,000, or sorry, in 2016 is $180,000. So what y'all were looking at there was the top of the box. So it's this giant gantry supporting these chimes, and it could be up to two octaves, C to C, chromatic octaves, and these little electric mechanisms firing these little pistons that beat the top of the chimes. And the what sounded like camera flashes are these just giant sparks going off that I would imagine are a tremendous out of code, out of date fire hazard nowadays. And I saw a video about the restoration, and they don't restore them to that original like giant spark flying balls of fire. They use a different safer mechanism. So yeah, I thought of that immediately because I know I went up to a snuck up to a bell tower when I was a kid with a neighborhood friend, and it was just such a dirty bell tower. A spark like that would be really dangerous.
Catastrophic.
yeah. So those are Deegan tower chimes, and they still exist around the country. You can find YouTube videos of various installations, and if you go to Deegan.com, it will take you straight to a website where, Deegan.com is the little ad page for a company called Top Rung Tower Chime and Organ Services. And so, yeah, they talk about how they can reservice and fix your Deegan tower chimes if you had them installed way back when. And apparently it says, in business since 1987, Top Rung Tower Chimes and Organ Services has restored 35 Deegan tower chime systems. And I believe they said they've installed the original Deegan company. Yeah, the J.C. Deegan Company of Chicago, Illinois, built some 440 of these Noble instruments between 1917 and 1958. So there's a lot of them all around the country, and a lot of them are in disrepair, but a lot of them do still work. So
I'm just thinking about at that price, how much money they made off of just those.
Yeah, I mean, apparently they were pretty popular. It seems like such a wild idea, though, you know, like to manufacture that and get that off the ground is huge. And I tried to think.
But it seems also like a sort of like almost Henry Fordism, like if there's a really good instrument manufacturer that can sort of standardize the way that these should be made and reuse equipment and use their already existing tuning procedures, I'm sure it's a lot cheaper than building that many custom carillons, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, and I'm sure, yeah, chimes are way cheaper than bells.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can't imagine. At my old university, I taught at Concord University, they had a carillon, which was very cool, of course, but it was always in the campus news, always in the town news, you know, restoring the carillon, the money it costs to keep it up every year. And I mean, just expensive, expensive, expensive. I think, yeah, chimes are, you know, tubular bell chimes are so much simpler than actual bells.
I just wish so much that obviously this is not possible. I just wish that we could have Mr. Deegan on the podcast. Like, he seems like such a cool, like, bizarre inventor. Like, if we get one episode where we can time travel, that's who we're having.
This thing was cool because, you know, of course, it had a little console that you could play these through piano rolls, so it could read piano rolls, or it had a little keyboard console that you could play from. And it also had a device that you could relay it to an organ. So you could hook it to, you know, one of your organ manuals that was already installed and play the organ, but then maybe on this one manual you can activate the chimes. So Deegan Tower Chimes, that's your sound for the day.
Cool.
And that's all before MIDI was the thing. I just thought about, like, by today's standards, like, oh yeah, it's just MIDI basically, but man, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, we do have one more question for Jim, and we mentioned it earlier, but we kind of got onto some other things, and it's from our friend Will Marinelli. Thanks for always sending in questions, Will. He says, what do you think are the most essential non-musical skills a percussionist needs to have in this day and age?
Ooh.
I think this gets asked a lot.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think maybe I would say just to be being curious. Just because I think what we do, there's a lot of ambiguity in, you know, like just when you think about someone writes a part, and these even just straight, more straightforward orchestral parts, someone writes a part and it's playing a cymbal note. And to play this cymbal note, you're, you know, crashing two pieces of metal together, you know, and to get the best sound. And I think that for me, the percussionists I've heard that I'm most inspired by are people that are always kind of trying to get better sounds. So they're always curious about what can I do differently. And that's not to say that, you know, it's bad to pull out your favorite pair of cymbals and use them for a note because you like them the best. But I do think that, you know, being curious, always kind of looking for new ways to approach things, looking for different sounds, looking for a different pair of sticks. I think those things are really important just because, you know, what we do, I think, can get stale. I think, like, if you're someone who, for example, just with orchestra playing, if you're someone that is like, every time I play this piece, I have to use this drum and use these sticks and that's it, then it becomes maybe a less exciting experience for you. And because of that, it's probably going to be a less exciting experience for the audience and your colleagues. So I think being curious keeps it interesting. And I think it, you know, allows you to, no matter what you're doing, to get better at it. And it allows you to, you know, kind of inviting other people that you're playing with to be curious. And I think it's just something that I've noticed, you know, here in Seattle, my colleagues are all very curious, which is really fun for me because it pushes me to kind of always look for better ways of doing things.
It must be hard to do that sometimes. You're playing, say a Beethoven symphony, and there's such a path and tradition. And but do you still find you're able to think that way even with, say, something as, you know, as known as Beethoven 3?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, this year, I'm maybe not as curious as I want to be, because I think, you know, this year I'm on probation and I'm trying to do a really good job. So but I think part of it is almost just like the things that I know are pretty good, I'm falling back on a lot. But even like with Beethoven, you know, when you hear different recordings of Beethoven, sometimes it's done in like more of a Baroque style. So it's done with like smaller drums and harder sticks, and like calf heads. And then sometimes it's done with an orchestra and it's a big orchestra and they'll use bigger drums. Still, if you're on a standard set of timpani, they'll use the lower two drums and they'll use maybe sticks that are a little bit heavier and they'll get more sound, you know? So I think there are like little things like that are different. Or that can make everything different. And then another thing too is I think with stickings, for example, I know one thing when I was studying with Mr. Rabio, to bring it full circle, you know, he was a big proponent of knowing, you know, depending on who you're playing with, if you're playing with strings, like knowing what bowing they're doing. And then if you're playing with brass, knowing if they're single tonguing or double tonguing or what articulation they're doing. And then depending on what they're doing, you can stick it differently. You can use different sticks to match and to blend more. And I think that when you're playing Beethoven, you know, those things are done differently every time, right? The string players might say, okay, because of this tempo, we're going to bow this differently. And then if you're playing with them, you can look at that and say, oh, you know, there's a way that I can stick this that's going to be different, but that's going to allow me to blend with them more. So I think things like that allow those, you know, big pieces that are done all the time, like Beethoven 3 or Beethoven 5 or whatnot. I think it allows that each time to be kind of a unique, exciting experience instead of kind of like checking a box and, you know, doing the same, using the same sticks and doing it the same way every time.
No, that's really cool. That's such a good lesson. You know, it's like, okay, don't just, you know, don't just do it and get your check mark done for the day and get your thumbs up, but try to like see what other extra layers of goodness you can bring to it, you know.
Yeah,
very cool. Well, you guys, thanks so much. I think we stayed just under an hour. So, man, Jim Benoit, it's great to have you on and see you again. We don't catch up enough, so this is awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, sure. You're very welcome. Ben, Carly, we'll catch you next time, where the plan will be to have Lee Hinkle and Anders Astrom will just be sitting in. That'll be his second appearance on the podcast. We think that's the plan. We'll see. So Lee Hinkle definitely, though. So yeah, thanks everyone. We'll catch you later.
Cool.
Carly, cool. Ben, you didn't say bye. That was